I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For the first time in 50 years, the Kansas City Chiefs are Super Bowl champions. And as we speak, Chiefs Kingdom is congregating on the streets of KC to celebrate its feat. Today we check in with KCUR journalists on the ground covering the parade and sports reporters here in studio. We also want to hear from you. Call in and share your celebration stories. Just don't do it while you're driving. Then the next big thing in the Internet of Things could be something called the Ring doorbell. But is there anything you can do to make sure your security devices are secure? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. It's parade day in Kansas City as we honor our Super Bowl champion Chiefs. We'll examine what brought us to this extraordinary day and we'll get updates from the rally. Later, are you trusting your home security system to take care of things while you're away? We'll get some thoughts on how secure those digital gadgets really are. And now for some more good news, we go down to Pershing Road, where KCUR newscasters Kyle Palmer and Lisa Rodriguez have been since very early this morning. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Is it still morning?
I have news for you, Lisa. I think it is. You both have a view of both Union Station and the hill opposite that leads up to the Liberty Memorial. What's it looking like right now?
Yeah, well, we are in the Institute of Human Development on the fifth floor of the Pershing Lofts, just on the southwest corner facing Union Station. Right. We're in a corner office, so we're looking out over the north field of the World War I Museum and Memorial, and as Lisa can attest because she's on the other side of the table from me but has a better view, I mean, there is a sea of red fans from the front of Union Station all the way back up to the Liberty Memorial on that hill. It's very much looking like that famous picture from the 2015 World Series, but instead of blue, it's red.
And we've seen this crowd grow. When we got here and I first went outside at about 4:30, there were just a couple hundred people that had set up tents. They were in sleeping bags. They'd stayed the night. And very steadily, this crowd grew from hundreds to thousands to tens of thousands, and it's a big party out there.
You know, some concern this morning as a car somehow made its way onto the parade route. Recap what happened there for us.
So what happened is a car made it through the barricades at the very start of the parade. That's at 6th and Grand, and actually traveled nearly the entire parade route and until it was finally stopped by Kansas City police right in front of Crown Center, on right on Pershing there. I talked to a couple people who were there at the end who were terrified, had a moment of real panic where, you know, this car is kind of barreling down and spinning out of control as the cops try to control it. But luckily and thankfully, no one was injured. It did not actually break the barricade. And cops have two suspects in custody from that car chase.
You know, the city has been working since before the Super Bowl to plan this celebration. What do we know about that process?
We know the process started as early as a year ago, the last time the Chiefs played in the AFC Championships, and unfortunately that was a more of a disappointing finish. So city officials at that point knew that it was possible, had the Royals parade under their belt already, and started then planning that event.
Yeah, and we've been hearing from both our reporters like Laura Ziegler, Noah Taborda, and Peggy Lowe, who have also been out on the parade route today, that everything does seem to be fairly organized, that the city may have learned a lot of lessons from that 2015 World Series parade. It is not, at least from our vantage, felt as chaotic as that event 5 years ago, or nearly 5 years ago, felt at times, even though it was a very joyous event on a right. Clear blue day. There still were some moments of chaos, but this has felt, in terms of where, getting people where they need to go, felt a lot more organized.
Well, I know that Lisa
still
has
early on. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I know that Lisa has talked with the city's chief communications officer, that's Chris Hernandez, on this very topic. Let's take a listen to what Chris said.
Well, if you recall, we made it all the way to the AFC Championship last year. Unfortunately, didn't get to go to the Super Bowl, but you know, similar to what happened 4 years ago where the Royals made two consecutive big runs, we kind of knew, okay, you know, we've still got Patrick Mahomes. If everyone stays healthy, the team keeps winning, this is a possibility. So we just kind of worked the planning in over the course of many months to other things that we were doing. Great partnership with the Kansas City Sports Commission and O'Neill Events because they know how to pull off these big events. They worked with us on the World Series Championship Parade as well. So it was always there. It was a matter of, like, making sure our plans were up to date and ready to go if this happened.
And what kinds of details do you have to take into consideration when you think that maybe a million people might come to one event?
You know, any huge event where you get massive crowds in downtown Kansas City, it involves pretty much all hands on deck for the police department and the fire department and hundreds of other city staff members from other departments, parks. Think about all the guys who are going to be here overnight cleaning up the trash that is left behind by this massive crowd. So it is a huge effort. It takes a lot of planning. We've done that. We think we have a good event on tap for today, and I can't wait to see the Lombardi Trophy rolling down the streets of downtown Kansas City.
And how did the weather affect today? Is that affecting your estimates for crowd size at all? Do you think it's going to discourage people from coming out?
Well, we're not doing crowd size estimates. We are just encouraging everyone to come down and have a great time. Dress warm. Wear your red. It's February in Kansas City, and this is a football crowd. We know how to handle the winter.
Yeah, we've heard that sentiment a lot, Steve. That was Lisa talking with city spokesperson Chris Hernandez earlier this morning, but we've heard that sentiment a lot of Chiefs fans know how to take care of themselves. They're hearty stock going to Arrowhead Stadium in December and January games, so this does have a feel of a football tailgate for sure.
Well, that's KCUR newscasters Kyle Palmer and Lisa Rodriguez. We'll check in back with you in just about 20 minutes here, okay?
Yeah, thanks right. a lot.
Thank you
thanks.
Both. Appreciate it. Well, I can recall broadcasting from Kauffman Stadium when the Royals made it to the World Series back in 2014 and looking down on the field from the press box and seeing the World Series logo in the grass and thinking, wow, this is really happening. Well, now I'm thinking the Chiefs have won the Super Bowl. It really happened. Some of the same feelings there. This morning, we'll run down the state of the Chiefs as this parade prepares to get underway. We'll talk about what happened on Sunday evening and what the future portends for this team and its very great young quarterback. With us to kick things off here this morning, Greg Eklund, a sports contributor for KCUR. Greg, nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Kenitra Pulliams is a freelance sports reporter. Kenitra, nice to have you, too.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And we're also joined now by Joe Poznanski. He's a senior writer at The Athletic, co-founder of Passions in America, author of five books, including The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini, and lots of folks in Kansas City remember Joe as a former sports columnist for the Kansas City Star. Joe, good morning. Nice to have you. You there, Joe? Hey, Joe, are you there?
I am here. Hello.
Yeah, good to have you, Joe. You know, You just tweeted this the other day. For 15 years, and I'm quoting your tweet here, I wrote sports columns in Kansas City. The Royals were never good. The Chiefs never won a playoff game. The Royals had no plan. The Chiefs couldn't develop a quarterback. And it's now clear that the problem all along was me. What do you mean the problem all along was you, Joe?
Look, I leave town and everything goes great. It's like instantly as soon as I leave. So, you know, it was so much fun for me in Kansas City, and you know, there were so many wonderful things to write about, but I just couldn't be happier to see, you know, this success. I mean, obviously, I was super excited when the Royals won the World Series, and then this Chiefs team not only winning the Super Bowl, but winning it with such a fun and exciting young team with a, you know, brilliant young quarterback. I mean, this is pretty great stuff.
Hey, do you feel like you've missed out, Joe?
Well, I would have loved to write about a young Patrick Mahomes for sure. You know, when the Chiefs were in the middle of you know, getting every backup quarterback in the NFL during that stretch of time. So, you know, not that it wasn't fun writing about Steve Bono and Elvis Gerback and Rich Gannon and, you know, and even Trent Green who ended up being very good, but you know, they were importing all these guys in and hoping sort of for a little lightning in the bottle thing. And so to see them draft a young quarterback, you know, develop him very quickly and for him to turn into, you know, I think the best quarterback in the NFL and one of the most exciting people in sports, Sure, of course, I would have loved to do that, but I'm thrilled. I really am. You know, my daughter and my wife are, you know, both natives and just gigantic Chiefs fans, and so watching them watch the Super Bowl, it was a little bit like being back at home.
Well, some of us, Joe, even to this day, remember some of your columns. And one of them, if I recall right, you were on the sidelines for one of those home Chiefs playoff losses, watching the last 2 minutes as the Chiefs fought chaos and just couldn't get it done. Take us back to that moment.
Wow. I mean, there was more than one of those. I mean, there was obviously the Colts game where neither team punted and it came down to a fumble. And there was the Broncos game where if Tony Gonzalez had landed in bounds, you know, that might have changed the whole complexion of the game. I mean, the thing that looking back, it wasn't so obvious at the time, but looking back, you saw these Chiefs teams that I think the whole town had built up all of this hope for, and they were very good. Those were very good teams, but they were all flawed in sort of a significant way. You know, none of them did you feel like you were putting the best quarterback on the field, for instance.
Right.
I mean, all of them seemed, you know, that incredible 2003 team that scored all those points. I mean, the defense couldn't stop anybody. So you felt like there was a flaw, there was something that could hold that team back. And, you know, this team takes the field and you know, they fall behind 24-0, and you still feel like, wow, they can come back. I mean, there's nothing really preventing them from coming back. And you know, obviously it was a magical run, and I don't know that you want to live on trying to keep coming back from 10 points down in every single game you play.
Right.
But this team just is fundamentally different, I think, than those teams were. And of course, this team ends up winning it.
And so much of that falls back on the quarterback, right, Joe?
Well, it's the most important position by far. And yes, I don't think it's just having a good quarterback, because I think, for instance, the 49ers, I think that Jimmy Garoppolo is a good quarterback. I think it's having a sort of a generational talented quarterback. I mean, that's certainly what has led, well, the Patriots to all those Super Bowls, the Colts when Peyton Manning was winning all those Super Bowls, the Packers where Aaron Rodgers. I mean, it's having somebody special as a quarterback, and Patrick Mahomes just does everything so well. It's not just, you know, that he's a great passer. It's not that he's a great runner. It's not that he's so imaginative. And all of those things are true, but the way he carries himself, he's
right.
So likable. He's so much. Everybody wants to win for him. I mean, there's that's special. It's Kansas City to have a player like that. I was trying to think of the last time Kansas City had sort of the single coolest athlete in sports, right? Like the one that everybody in sports. And I think you probably have to go back to Bo Jackson.
Right.
That's the last time that the whole country looked to Kansas City and thought, wow, that's the guy you want.
We might have this guy for 20 more years, Joe. So it's happy times here in Kansas City. That's Joe Posnanski, senior writer at The Atlantic. His latest book, The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini. He was on the show a few months ago talking about that very book. Joe, what a pleasure to always have you on the show. Sure appreciate it.
Thanks. Absolutely. It was great.
And if our listeners are on their way to the parade or maybe are already along the route and give us a sense of what they're seeing around them, we'd like to hear from all of you. 816-235-2888 is our number. 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I want to go back to our guests in the studio here, Kenitra Pulliams, Greg Eklund. Kenitra, you had some thoughts on what lessons this city learned from the World Series parade back in 2015 that used the same route as the Chiefs will use today. What did we learn from that experience?
Planning is everything.
Planning,
you know,
yeah.
You make the preparations ahead of time for best case scenario,
mm-hmm.
so that you're not kind of surprised by what could be. You know, listening to Kathy Nelson talking about the preparations that are put in place.
The head of the sports commission.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
700 relief stations or porta potties.
I was going to say porta potties may be the key word.
You know,
here.
That's
yeah.
the thing. You know, and it's a lot different temperature wise between a World Series celebration in November versus mid February where there's snow coming or Mother Nature's confetti coming down from the sky. And so they're, you know, layer up, they're imploring parents, take pictures of your children. So if you do get separated, you know what they're wearing today, and you're not having to go through your phone trying to find an old picture. And so it's just kind of taking the steps, you know, an ounce of prevention is everything. You know, for parents, and there are more reunification stations for parents if they get separated, you know, from their children. And also, it's February in Kansas City. Wear layers, you know, take the necessary precautions so that you're not getting frostbite and you're not overcome by the elements.
All good advice there. You know, Greg, Andy Reid is saying he's not going anywhere, that he plans to be back next year as coach, not even cracking the door open an inch to the idea of retirement. And why not, right? He can coach Pat Mahomes for next season and for any number beyond that.
I think he enjoys what he's doing. He talked yesterday at Arrowhead Stadium in a news conference about just getting right back after it and through the same methods that he had carried on before. Getting in early, before all the guys came in, he had everything prepared for what he called the exit interviews with the players. He had all the remarks and all the points he wanted to make with each individual player all laid out before him, before they entered the building.
And when you say getting in early, from what I read, that means like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning.
That's what Patrick Mahomes said last week. He said, I tried to outwork him, but he's already in at 3 a.m. and doesn't leave until 11 p.m. But Patrick Mahomes says, as much as I'd like to work, I can't work as hard as Andy Reid.
You know, I just am so struck by Andy Reid's work ethic, because didn't he come from Philadelphia directly to the Chiefs? There was talk about, does this man need a season off? And Kenitra, he didn't. He wanted to get right back to it.
I mean, I think that's just the fire that burns within him and the dedication to the sport. And I think that's why he was the sentimental favorite. The Chiefs were the sentimental favorite because of Andy Reid to win the Super Bowl, just because of what Andy Reid has given to this sport, given to the NFL, and that he hasn't yet been able to hoist a Lombardi trophy. And so I think because of that, you know, he didn't need time off to just kind of restoke the fire. Mm-hmm. It still burns brightly and burns very hot, you know, for him, the passion for the game.
You know, you can't help, Greg. So much has been said about the connection between Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes. It sure seems to me that it's working and working pretty well. What do we know about their working relationship and why that relationship appears to be as successful as it is?
Well, Andy Reid, first off, is known for his offensive innovations. And with
he already says he's got a bunch of new plays stored up for next season.
And the fact that Patrick Mahomes has the innate ability to retain everything that Andy Reid passes along, and then has the athletic ability to not only retain what's in the playbook, but to ad lib, so to speak, if he needs to make a play downfield, which in a few instances in the fourth quarter he ended up doing, to have the ability of both to implement what is in the script and to go outside the script and still be successful, that's what makes it a perfect marriage.
You know, Kenitra, Pat Mahomes won the Super Bowl MVP award. We all know that, but you think some other Chiefs players were probably in the running for that honor as well. Who did you have in mind?
Namely, Damian Williams.
No kidding.
You know, yes, Patrick engineered kind of the comeback.
After kind of a rough first three quarters.
It was not his best game by any means. You know, but what Damian Williams was able to contribute, picking up the necessary fourth down on the little razzle-dazzle trick play, you know, as Greg, you alluded to, that you know, Patrick Mahomes said they've kind of rehearsed and practiced and practiced and practiced and had to find the right time to unveil the little twinkle toes pirouette to pick up the first down that Damian Williams was able to get. And then also just the tough running in which he did, because everyone was like, you know, the Chiefs ground game, you know, it's not all that. It's all Patrick Mahomes. But when the Chiefs needed to pick up the yards on the ground, I mean, Damian Williams.
He was right there.
He was
all
just
the time.
So crucial. And so to me, that's whom I would have voted for. For MVP.
And Damian Williams was on Jimmy Kimmel's show, which is maybe a sign that Jimmy Kimmel thought he was the MVP of that game as well. Did you think Damian was the MVP, Greg?
He had an MVP performance. He had a better overall game for four quarters than Patrick Mahomes's. Kenitra had mentioned, for the first three quarters, Patrick Mahomes wasn't playing very well. He had two interceptions before the fourth quarter started, or actually going into the early part of the fourth quarter. But it was not the kind of game that we were accustomed to seeing from Patrick Mahomes, while Damian Williams was keeping them in the game in various ways and then came through in the clutch moments at the end.
You know, Kenitra, aren't defensive linemen something at a distinct disadvantage here when it comes to winning, you know, big MVP awards in situations like the Super Bowl? Because a lot of folks were thinking that Chris Jones had a pretty good game, too.
Chris Jones, remember how his playoff started with the calf injury and not being able to go. And then all of a sudden, Steve Spagnuolo's wife delivers some magical meatballs to Chris Jones. And all of a sudden, he's healthy and he's cured and he's ready to play.
Is that what happened there?
That's what he said. He said, he goes, Miss Spags, the meatballs, you know, that was a secret to his success. And the pressure that he was able to get, and Terrell Suggs, you know, being able to get in there. And the experience of having won a Super Bowl with the Ravens, you know, I think that's crucial. But, I mean, Chris Jones... because we remember last year in the AFC Championship game, it's kind of the defense that prevented them.
And what makes it amazing is the fact that on the stat sheet, I think he was credited with only one tackle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just one single tackle. But because of the way he was able to disrupt the game by deflecting passes or putting out a rush on Jimmy Garoppolo, he made a difference.
Yeah, the number of balls batted down at the line.
Just to give you a sense how old I am, I can recall being a boy in Minnesota and a guy named Alan Page, a defensive tackle for the Minnesota Vikings, won the league MVP for the entire season based on his performance. And again, we haven't seen anything like that since, which shows you how rare something like this is.
And that performance was right before Alan Page's eyes, because in the 100-year celebration, Alan Page was in the stadium to see it firsthand.
Hmm. And I mean, and you look at, you know, the team awards were announced yesterday, and it wasn't Patrick Mahomes who won the team MVP for the Chiefs. It's Tyrann Mathieu.
Oh, I missed that. Is that right?
Yes.
I missed that.
He as voted on by his teammates and his coaches, the Derek Thomas Award goes to Tyrann Mathieu.
Oh, I did not hear that. That's interesting. Yeah. Are you surprised?
Not surprised, but it's kind of like, this is how Brett Veach built the team. They needed an emphasis and kind of re-energized defense. You bring in Steve Spagnuolo, you bring in Tyrann Mathieu, you kind of just redo the defense, and it paid, because defense wins championships, and here we are.
To what extent is the defensive coach, Spags they call him, underappreciated in this conversation? I mean, talk about a guy who turned around a team by making the defense something that could actually stop an offense.
It was a combination of Steve Spagnuolo not only implementing his scheme, but having the players to do it. And again, this goes back to Brett Veach getting Tyrann Mathieu, getting Frank Clark in the offseason, and getting some of those other unsung pieces like a Mike Pinnell and some of these other pieces that are not as big as the name value of Bashaud Breeland, who came from the Cowboys in a trade, but all of them in their own way making a significant contribution.
But the Honey Badger is the MVP, not Patrick Mahomes.
Yeah, I mean, and the Honey Badger, and a chance for him, as he said, to kind of rewrite his narrative of how he was perceived early on in his career, you know, and then with the Texans last year, and then now being able to come and become the defensive captain, you know, for the Chiefs, and to kind of reprogram, you know, how this Chiefs defense, I mean, it's so criticized and vilified about how Patrick Mahomes had to outscore every team because the defense was so inadequate.
Well, on this very exciting day, we're going to have to leave it right there. I want to thank Kenitra Pulliams, a freelance sports reporter, Greg Eklund, a sports contributor here at KCUR. Thank you both very much. I sure appreciate it.
You're welcome. Sure thing, Steve.
I'm going to go back to Kyle Palmer and Lisa Rodriguez, who are in downtown Kansas City, right across from Union Station, watching this big parade unfold here. The parade is coming. The rally begins later on today. Kyle, what are you seeing?
Well, we are actually watching a video feed that they're broadcasting to the crowd here at Union Station, and we are seeing that the parade itself has set off. We're seeing open-air buses with Chiefs players. We're seeing TV shots of the likes of Tyrann Mathieu and Patrick Mahomes, who you were just discussing with your guests. And so the crowd here is also seeing that and getting excited, realizing that those buses will be down here in roughly 2 hours for the planned rally at 1:30.
So you can feel the energy in the crowd, Kyle, as this parade has formally kicked off here.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I'll pass it off to Lisa, who's here with me at the Institute of Human Development, overlooking this scene in the north yard of the World War I Museum and Memorial. She's been out in that crowd at various points throughout the day, and it has just been steadily and consistently growing all morning.
It has been consistently growing. And people, you can hear, and we've certainly heard here in this office, the volume of that crowd outside really increase over the last few minutes. People are excited. They're ready to get this parade going and cheer on their team.
And there's we got a sound from a fan from up the parade route on Grand Boulevard. I think he's at Record Bar near 16th and Grand. Here's what he has to say just as this parade is setting off.
I'm feeling so good. I'm feeling so amazing. First time in 50 freaking years. Oh, my God. There's confetti falling on me. I don't know if it's snow or confetti, but, hey, I'm just feeling amazing. I love you, KC.
It was very gentlemanly of him to check his language there.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
I don't
was.
Know if everybody at this parade would do that.
Lisa Rodriguez, I remember the Chiefs, the World Series celebration in front of the station. Things got a little tense, a little tight there for a few minutes as the crowd was just so many people packed into a small space. People weren't misbehaving. It was just too many people in a small space. How concerned are you about something similar for this Chiefs rally this afternoon?
I think at the moment, and the last time I was down in the crowd was probably about 40 minutes ago, and it was movable. It was tight, but movable. But that will be something to watch, because as this parade continues down the route, if people want to follow this parade down to the rally at the end, then things are going to get very packed. So I think that'll be something to keep an eye on. But I will say there is a lot of security out here. There are different stations that are handing out water and checking on people's well-being. And so the city has all hands on deck for a situation like that.
Well, good for Kansas City. I want to thank Kyle Palmer, Lisa Rodriguez, both from KCUR. We'll check in with them later on as our show comes to a conclusion today. But coming up in our second half, is your Ring doorbell spying on you? We'll speak to a Kansas City attorney who's helping lead a class action lawsuit against a company that makes them. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, on the heels of President Trump's State of the Union address last night, we'll look at what makes a presidential speech memorable and ask how some presidential words go from memorable to eternal. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, not long ago, doorbell surveillance was all the rage. Kansas City police were even handing them out to residents in high crime areas. But now a different side of the devices has emerged, with one family reporting that one of the devices in an 8-year-old girl's bedroom was hacked by a person who then shouted racial slurs. In a different home, a hacker spied on a family, then threatened them with termination if they didn't pay a ransom. Video surveillance is increasingly popular, but how are people supposed to protect their property and privacy in a technologically driven society? By the way, cameras aren't the only thing being used against you. Smartwatches, Fitbits, Google Home devices, and more are leaving customers feeling vulnerable to hacks, giving away sensitive information. With us here to talk about all this, Austin Moore is a partner at the Stevie Siegel Law Firm. Austin, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Lily Hay Newman is a senior writer at Wired who focuses on information security, digital privacy, and hacking. She joins us from NPR in New York. Lily, good morning to you.
Hi, how are you?
Good, and thanks for joining us. You know, Austin, some folks might be wondering why a Ring device, which, you know, normally you think about it being used as a doorbell to monitor what's going on outside your house, wound up in an 8-year-old girl's bedroom. Help me understand that.
Yeah, Steve. Well, lots of families are starting to install Ring cameras inside their homes for various purposes. It could be to monitor the house, could be to watch over the kids, could be to watch the dog. But in our
so it's like the old baby monitor when I was a dad.
Absolutely. And in our client's case, we represent a Mississippi family. They have 4 young daughters. One of the girls has seizures, has a history of them. Her mother works the overnight shift at a local hospital and wants to check in on her at night. So they put cameras up in the room.
Huh. Lily Newman with Wired. You know, video surveillance is getting really popular despite these risks. Why does everyone want cameras everywhere these days?
Well, it's funny how there's sort of a security issue on both sides. Like, on the one hand, people are buying these devices or, you know, receiving them through giveaways because of security concerns, you know, on their property, at their house, or, as Austin is saying, you know, wanting to keep tabs on things inside their homes. But unfortunately, there's also just a bit of a trade-off in terms of a potential cybersecurity risk or exposure that can come from these devices. So it's sort of the good and the bad.
You know, Lily, you can't help but wonder these days, is there such a thing as privacy anymore? You go walk your dog on the street at night and a camera's watching you.
Yeah, I think, again, there's just sort of trade-offs here, you know, in public spaces versus our private data versus sort of these gray areas like a suburban neighborhood where you might not expect there to be sort of a government or a corporate presence, but actually neighbors are, you know, putting up these cameras for totally benign, you know, personal reasons. And then suddenly that's impacting your privacy.
Austin Moore, how likely is it that these hackers in the cases you're involved with, you know, maybe had been watching these families before they actually revealed themselves? Is there a way to find that out?
Well, that's something we're going to explore during the lawsuit, but it certainly seems possible. In our clients' cases, they found out about it only because the hackers identified themselves.
They revealed themselves, if you will. Yeah,
absolutely. But they, once you have access to that account, you can watch videos, you can watch live feeds, you can watch historical footage. So it's really a terrifying thought.
Hmm. Lily, maybe the big question here is, how easy is it to actually hack these doorbell security devices and many of the other things that we wear these days, like Fitbits?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that in these types of cases with smart home devices, as you're saying, smart assistants, doorbells, all these things, often these aren't really hacks. It's more of a situation where login credentials that users have reused on multiple sites get breached in one place and then used to get into other accounts. So, you know, Ring doorbells may not have had a breach. They may not have a specific vulnerability in these situations, but it's very easy to find the credentials somewhere else and then use them to just walk in the front door of the account, basically, and log right in. And as Austin's saying, get access to everything once you have that account. So, you know, the crucial thing is setting up additional layers of protection, and the companies encouraging users to set up those layers of protection so that it's not just a username and password. There's more to it, and it's harder for people to get in.
So, Austin, are we saying that maybe if you can figure out the password to a Ring doorbell device, that perhaps the homeowner might be using that same password for his checking account, his or her checking account?
Yeah, you know, Steve, that could be one way in. We don't think it's the only way in. We've a couple of our clients used 16-character unique passwords specifically for their Ring accounts that were not used elsewhere, yet hackers still got in. Well, how does that happen?
Yeah.
There's a few different methods that we've identified as part of our case that we think are real, meaningful security vulnerabilities. One, Ring doesn't necessarily lock you out if a user is attempting multiple passwords.
Oh, okay.
So there's tools that can be purchased for cheap on underground markets that are automated and will try every password combination until they get in. Many technology companies say after 3 to 5 attempts, you're locked out, or they notify the user. That wasn't happening here.
Huh. And that's kind of surprising to me.
Very surprising. And other common methods of preventing these types of unauthorized access or using multi-factor authentication. So if I enter my email and password to log in, I've got to provide a second form of authentication to get in, which could be a text message, it could be security questions. Again, Ring wasn't utilizing these very standard methods.
You know, I use those two-factor methods for any number of things, including my 401k. And I can't help but wonder, Austin, how secure is that approach? Because it sort of drives me crazy sometimes, but I get the reasoning behind it, obviously.
Well, it certainly helps, because if you've got to get a text message on your cell phone, the hacker who's 10, 15 states over in another country, there's just no way that person's going to be able to get in.
Huh. Ring.com. What else, Lily, should people do to make themselves safe? What else would you throw out here that, as we have this nerve-wracking conversation, people might want to think about?
Yeah, I agree with all the comments about, you know, two-factor, multi-factor authentication, adding as many layers as possible so that, you know, no matter what's going on with the username and password, there's still something, an extra component that the attackers need. And the other thing that I suggest to people is just minimizing the number of devices that you have. You know, these devices are helpful, they're useful, and if there's a real utility to something and a real quality of life improvement from having it, like, for example, being able to check in on a, you know, a sick kid or something like that, that's obviously incredibly valuable. But a lot of times we just end up with these devices because someone gave them to us or it seems nifty or something like that. And if it's not providing a real benefit in your life, I would, you know, reduce so that that way there's less that a hacker can attack in the first place.
Can I ask, Lily, do you wear a Fitbit? Do you have a radio in your home that might be vulnerable to hacking? How do you manage this in your own life?
I do take my own advice on this. I have as few Internet of Things devices as possible, but I also carry a phone around all the time. So, you know, it's not to say that it's easy to get rid of everything. I just think it's a good idea to reduce as much as possible.
Austin, what do you do?
Yeah, I'm similar to Lily. I've been close enough to see kind of what can happen when you are granting technology companies and big tech inside your home. So I try to avoid it for the most part. But like Lily mentioned, sometimes it's unavoidable. We all use phones. I use an Apple Watch. A lot of our movement, a lot of our conversations are being tracked.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the security risks that devices like Ring doorbells pose for so many residents in Kansas City and across the country. Austin, if you would, tell us about your class action lawsuit that's aimed at the makers of these doorbell devices. How many people are you representing? What's going on?
Sure, Steve. So at the very beginning of the year, we filed a class action against Ring in their home district, which is in the Central District of California. They're based in Santa Monica. We initially filed suit with two couples. We have since been contacted by several others. We anticipate that they could be included in the suit later down the road. But there are reports that these types of attacks have happened to families across the country. So as part of the case, we're going to seek discovery on how many verified instances this has happened. But based on news reports alone, we think it's hundreds.
You know, in one of these cases where the device was hacked that was sitting in this 8-year-old girl's bedroom was absolutely horrifying. Tell us what happened there.
Right. So just several days after the family installed the cameras in their house, around 8 p.m., both cameras activated, and music started playing. And it turns out that the hacker was playing a theme song from a horror film.
Yes.
And
what was the song? Because it's horrifying to even think about it.
It was by Tiny Tim from the 60s. And
Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
That's right. Yeah. It was used in the film Insidious back in 2010.
It's a creepy, I mean, if it's played in the right sense, it's a creepy song.
Absolutely,
yeah.
It is. And the 8-year-old daughter went to her room to explore where the music was coming from. She walks in there, the music stops, and a voice starts interacting with her. Hello there. Starts saying racial slurs. Starts encouraging her to misbehave, starts claiming to be Santa Claus. And for a young child who has no clue how this type of technology could work, I mean, it's a terrifying experience. And to that end, she ran out eventually screaming for her mom, and her dad had to come up and figure out what was happening and eventually disable the devices.
The way to disable that, ensure it doesn't happen, is just to disconnect it from the power, right?
Yes, that's what he did.
Yeah. And where does your case stand right now, Austin?
It's in the very early stages, so there have been a couple of other cases filed. Likely they'll be related together in the same court, and it will probably take a few months before we really get off the ground.
You know, I'm struggling with one aspect of your case that I read about last night, because Ring, the manufacturer here, is saying that it won't disclose the identities of the hackers. Why not?
You know, we don't really know. The issue from our client's perspective, obviously, is that they don't know who was perpetrating these attacks. They don't know if they're still at risk. They don't know if they're at risk of a physical harm. So our understanding is that law enforcement has been involved in every one of these instances, but they don't necessarily have to keep you apprised about what their investigation shows. And Ring has really failed to disclose anything they know about the attacks.
You know, Lily, I'm wondering about sort of the arc in our culture of the popularity of these devices. They seem to have come on the scene with a bang, a lot of people interested in them. But you hear about these situations that Austin is describing, and it sets you back a little bit. I'm wondering, what's your sense of how popular these devices are now, and if Ring is responding to, in a way to improve the security around these devices?
Yeah, I think, you know, all connected devices like this, just the popularity kind of exploded. And, you know, Ring is maybe the newest trend, or, you know, a newer one in most people's minds. But there, I think, was a real disconnect where the popularity surged and the products were very compelling and sort of exciting. But it took longer for the sort of downsides or the privacy considerations and like reality to set in, basically, you know. So I think that is sort of all catching up now, and many companies, including Ring, are starting to respond to this sort of increasing public pressure. Ring has taken some steps, and, you know, other companies have also responded to pressure, but I think there's just sort of a conceptual shift that needs to happen. The companies are hesitant to promote things like two-factor authentication or multi-factor authentication very strongly, even if they offer it, it'll, you know, often be sort of a side thing, because they're worried about making it too difficult to set up the products, mm-hmm. you know, that people just get discouraged right. and not want to buy it or not want to use it. So they're a little hesitant to add in that layer, but I think, you know, now they need to really be starting to say, okay, how can we make it as easy as possible? How can we provide clear instructions so everybody's doing it, everyone has, you know, extra protections, and we can kind of move forward from that baseline instead of the place that we're at?
You know, Lily, I saw a little clip on the local news not long ago about these devices and how people, you know, how obviously these cameras can help you spot someone coming up on your front porch and stealing a package from Amazon that's just been delivered, for instance. But now it seems like the bad guys understand all they have to do is sort of lower their head, wear a hoodie and lower their head. You can't see their faces, and it makes it impossible to identify the person who steals your package. You know, is there a way around these devices that's rendering them less effective than we had hoped they would be?
Well, security is always a cat and mouse game, not to be cliche, but it just that's the nature of it. There's always this cyclical element of, you know, creating new defenses, to hackers defeating them, and then that motivating, you know, a next generation of new defenses. So it's always that cycle. And again, I just think it goes back to having a real, you know, taking some real time to think about what the benefit you're getting is from any given device. You know, if it makes you feel more secure, or you're seeing things from your doorbell camera, you know, a package stuff or people approaching your house or whatever that is helpful to you, or, you know, is accomplishing the goal, then I think that's very valid. But as you're saying, if people are getting around the protection anyway, and you're not able to see who delivered the package anyway or who grabbed it off your porch, then maybe you don't need it anymore and it's not really working for you. So it's just important to, you know, give that consideration.
You know, Austin, if police are involved in distributing these devices to homeowners in high crime areas, for instance, are the police on the hook here if these devices get hacked? Are the departments suddenly susceptible to lawsuits because they were involved in encouraging their use?
To my knowledge, that hasn't occurred yet, but...
Might it? It's
certainly not outside the realm of possibility. In all of our cases, you look for causation. Is there a causal connection between the harm and the cause? And in this case, if you were persuaded to install a camera by a third party, a police department, and you eventually suffered a harm because of that, certainly they could be facing liability.
Yeah. Bottom line, Austin, do you know how many lawsuits have been filed against Ring and similar device manufacturers in recent months?
I know there have been 3 class action lawsuits. I believe those will be consolidated, but we are expecting several more.
Lily, tell us any more that you might have come across about what's being done to stop hackers from doing what they do.
I think companies are, in addition to, you know, promoting the protections that we talked about and adding them,
right,
you know, as Austin was saying, making sure there's protections on how many password attempts you can have, things like that. The companies say that they've been adding more monitoring into their systems so they can try to detect intrusions sooner, you know, detect strange activity, things like that. But I think the connected device or Internet of Things security question is still really an open question. I report on this stuff every day, all the time. You know, it never ends. With all sorts of devices in homes, you know, consumer devices, but also enterprise devices in critical infrastructure. You know, it just goes on and on because anything with a tiny chip in it is a computer, you know, and we don't think of it that way. But your desk phone at your office,
right,
it's really a computer, you know, all these things. So they're really, as I was saying before, is just...
I've got to wrap here, Lily. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your comments. That's Lily Hay Newman, a senior writer at Wired. She focuses on this information. Austin Moore, a partner at Stevie Siegel Law Firm, who's filed a lawsuit in this case. Thank you both for a good conversation. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for having us.
I'm going to go back to downtown Kansas City and our team, Lisa Rodriguez and Kyle Palmer, right across the street from Union Station. And Kyle, what are you seeing out your window now? Just how excited is this crowd as the parade begins to wind towards them?
Well, just as they were 20 minutes ago, but just even more so now, they're watching the parade, the buses full of players, and some of the players now actually getting out of the buses and walking down Grand. We are seeing that the buses are over the highway and now past the River Market, so they're making their way down, and I think people just kind of waiting here, listening to some music, doing some chants, and getting ready for the 1:30 rally.
Lisa, as you look out the window where you are, just how large is this crowd? Describe what you're seeing to us.
I mean, it's at this point, it is a sea of red. There is just on the part of the lawn closest to us, there are a couple patches of grass that are available, but beyond that, there is just no space at all. This crowd is big, and I think as this parade makes its way down, it's going to get a little bigger.
Yeah, and there are a couple of big gnarly trees in the yard of the World War I Museum, and there are people sitting in those trees over the crowd. There are also some people sitting kind of precariously on the bluffs underneath the Westin Hotel across the street from the Union Station. I'm looking straight out the window and seeing them. So people trying to find space wherever they can.
Lisa, just quickly, can you compare the size of this crowd to the Royals? Is there any way to know at this point if there's any difference?
I think it would be hard to tell, but earlier today we were saying, it doesn't look quite as big, and now I'm looking at it and thinking, this is going to be at least as big, and I won't be surprised if it is much bigger.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Lisa Rodriguez, Kyle Palmer reporting live from the Union Station area. Thank you both. Appreciate it very much. Have a good time.
Thanks,
Thank
Steve.
You.
You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow on the show, what makes a presidential address truly historic and memorable? Is it the number of applauses? We'll find out. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.